Right, so good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the last lecture in the short series. I'm going to be talking today on developing an industrial sector in the context of a globalizing, rapidly globalizing world, a very competitive world, and we're going to put ourselves in the shoes of the South African policymakers in the mid-1990s, after the first democratic elections, facing the problem of how to restructure a very important industry in the South African context. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Anthony Black, also from the School of Economics. And what I'll do is talk for about 45, 50 minutes. I think we should keep questions for the end, unless there are really pressing questions about, you know, of clarification or something like that. And I think everyone should be able to hear me, but if you can't, please wave. My mother has been a regular participant at the summer school, and she's been giving me advice all week that I must talk loudly and clearly. Okay. And I apparently yesterday came across a bit too quietly. Okay, so if you can hear me, good. Right, so just to give you an outline, actually in the handbook it did say the words of environmental issues was mentioned, but in preparing this I actually decided there simply wasn't enough space, but there may be questions about environmental issues to do with the motor industry which we can deal with at the end. In fact, at COP17 at the end of last year in Durban, I test drove some electric cars, and I was actually very, very impressed. So in fact, I'm going to start some research in this area because I was so impressed with how they performed. But I won't be actually touching on that too much in today's talk. Right, so we'll start with global developments. What is the context for the South African industry? Then I'm going to look at South Africa's automotive policy and look at some particular issues, volume and scale of production. That might not mean too much at this point, but I'll explain that as we go along. We'll look at growth performance and perhaps end with, and this might be a subject for debate at the end, is should this sector, which has received a lot of government support in the past, should it continue to receive this level of government support, or in fact any further government support? Okay, so we'll just start with a quotation from this was the International Motor Vehicle Program at MIT. Let me just see if I move away, can you still hear me? I've got a lapel mic. No, it's a bit soft, isn't it? So let me stay at the mic here. This is a report from MIT's International Motor Vehicle Program dating back to 1984, and it basically said, well, kind of indicated that, talking about Australia and South Africa, two major auto-producing regions which have had industries for many years, many decades, but had not at that stage developed an export industry. And the problem was their location, relatively high wages, small domestic markets, long shipping distances to major markets. So they're really, really questioning the feasibility of countries like Australia and South Africa at that time of developing a viable automotive industry. So this is really one of the first points I want to make. I mean, the first thing really is that this is a huge industry. It's the world's biggest manufacturing industry, and it's been kind of emblematic for many countries as a symbol of industrial development. So there have been, if you go back to the United States, it was very important, Japan, of course, Korea, think of China more recently, Brazil, Mexico. Many countries have used the automotive industry as a kind of leading symbol of industrial development and modernization. Now, it's also a very cyclical industry, so if there's an economic downturn, one of the first things we can do is reduce the number of cars that we put off buying a new car. And so you see with the economic crisis, financial crisis of 2008-2009, there was a huge dip in sales globally and in production, and then quite a significant recovery since then. So that just shows world motor vehicle production dating back to 98 and then projected into the future. I think more important for us is where Africa and South Africa stands in this huge global industry. And you'll see that on the right-hand side of the slide, let's see if I can, there we've got Africa, you can hardly see it. And this shows the global share production from 2005 to 2009. And clearly what we see is that North America, EU and Japan, which were the centers of the of this massive global industry, have to some extent been displaced. And then you see the huge increase of Asia, which is mainly being driven by China, of course, which is now the largest producing country in the world. So the point here is that, I mean, South Africa is the major part of African production, but you can see that we're talking, you know, we are really very small fish in a big pond. Okay. And I think the other point to see from this diagram is that the developing countries, South America and of course Asia, are seeing rapidly growing shares in world production, and the old centers of the industry, there you're seeing some quite significant decline. So if you look at the major producing countries, China, as I said, I mean, a huge increase in output, and is now by far the largest producer in the world. This shows global light vehicle production figures for the top eight countries, and from 2007, and also including a 2013 projection in the right-hand bar. So the top eight countries, and again, what you see is that the old producing countries like Japan, USA, Germany, are seeing their shares decline, and then you've got places like Thailand, of course China, Brazil, increasing their global share. So really this is an industry which is moving to emerging markets, which are the dynamic center of the world economy. They can produce more cheaply as well. South Africa, by the way, ranks currently 23rd in the world as a vehicle producer. So the question is now for our policy makers in the mid-90s, in the Department of Trade and Industry and elsewhere in government, to how do you restructure or develop this industry which already exists in South Africa, but is very small in global terms, and I'll say a bit more but later on, but in the mid-90s or early 90s was very inefficient and very uncompetitive. One of the first things you've got to think about is having a national automotive space, or this would be a key consideration for a policymaker. Because this is an industry which is really requires large-scale production. So you can't be producing for a very small market. You've got to think in terms of quite a large market because of economies of scale. You can only really reduce production costs per car produced by achieving high-volume production. So you need to think about defining a regional or national automotive space which may be protected by policy measures, for example, tariffs. Of course, you need to ensure that the industry is competitive and can attract foreign investment. And then policy needs to prepare the industry for a more open trading environment. Things have changed a little bit, but certainly if you go back the last decade, there's a lot of pressure on countries to reduce tariffs. That situation has now changed to some extent. Okay, so what do we mean by viable automotive spaces for emerging producer countries in this big global industry? Well, firstly, we can look at countries like China and India. And of course, you know, if you're a big dynamic economy with a billion people and a very rapidly growing market, developing this industry is not going to be too difficult. All you need to do is put a bit of a tariff around your border, import duty of some sort, doesn't need to be too high, and really the industry will take care of itself. So what you see is massive amounts of investment flooding into China and India, because they are extremely dynamic economies, as we know, with huge untapped and growing markets. Another type of automotive space, so that's one viable automotive space. Another type of automotive space would be what we call integrated peripheral markets. Think of Mexico on the border of the United States, where you've got, you're adjacent to a very large market, and Mexico has the potential advantage of lower wages, and with modern investments can be very efficient and competitive in that market. Another example would be the more recent EU member states like Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, who again have cheaper wages, and with modern investments they've become very efficient, and in fact they are now the lowest cost producers within the European Union. So you see the whole industry moving out of Germany, France, even the UK, and moving eastwards into these cheaper production regions. So these are integrated peripheral markets which again constitute a viable economic space for countries aspiring to participate in this industry. Another potential automotive space would be a regional market. Okay, so where you've got the country itself may not constitute a market, but if it's part of a free trade region, it may well constitute a viable market. And we can think here of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which comprises Thailand, Malaysia, Philippines, and Indonesia are the main countries. And Mercosur, which the main countries are Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay. So together those constitute quite significant markets and are sufficient to generate enough scale for the industry. Now, that leaves South Africa. I mean, where does South Africa rank in this situation? And of course it's a bit of a problem because we are quite a small market. We are not close to a major established market. And we are part of a regional, there's the SADC arrangement, for example, but that's actually quite a small market. I mean, South Africa really accounts for about 80% of the market in SADC. So, being part of SADC does not add much to this industry. It might, of course, in due course, but Africa has now become the second fastest growing region in the world, in fact. But the base is very low and the market is still very small. Okay, just to elaborate a bit on that, the importance of regional markets. I mean, here we've got Brazil, Turkey, India, and Malaysia. And I mean, it won't go into too much detail, but you can see that, I mean, for example, Brazil, it's part of Mercosur, as I mentioned. It's also got trade agreements with Mexico and Chile, and that expands the possibilities for Brazil to develop, apart from its own quite substantial domestic market. And then Turkey is a slightly different case. They're right on the border of the European Union, and they're part of the EU, not formally, but in terms of trade arrangements, they effectively are a member of the European Union. They've got a free trade agreement, and Turkey's got relatively low wages and is exporting very successfully into the European Union. India's got various trade agreements, but of course it's got a massive internal market which is growing rapidly, and Malaysia is not a big exporter but also has trade agreements. So these are just kind of four emerging markets, and I'm just demonstrating the importance of having a regional market, and especially in countries which are not like China or India. Okay, the other thing which is very common in this industry is the use of policy measures to support the industry. And this happens in developing countries and in fact also in the developed world, as I'll show you in a minute. So many countries have put in place tariffs, and these vary quite a lot, but you can see South Africa as kind of mid-level tariff. This is for passenger vehicles. In fact, the red line is actually light commercials. For some reason, that slipped off the key there. So it's passenger vehicles. The red line is actually light commercial vehicles, or commercial vehicles, in fact. Light commercial vehicles. So Thailand has very high tariffs on passenger cars and much lower on light commercials. Some countries, like India, receive very, very high tariffs, Thailand and also Vietnam. So South Africa is kind of midway in that. But the point here is that this is an industry where many countries are
really putting out all the stops to kind of protect and nurture their own industries. Okay, I won't go into all, there's a lot of detail on the slide, so I won't, but just to show you the big range of measures that countries, and we're looking here again at Brazil, India, Malaysia, and Turkey, the big range of measures that countries have put in place to support the industry. I mean, they vary a lot, there's tariffs, but apart from that, you've got all sorts of quite detailed plans in some cases. I mean, they've become less interventionist because of there are WTO constraints, but they can include support for R&D, as in Turkey and in some other countries. All sorts of industrial plans and support measures, support for investment, etc., to encourage investment in this sector. So again, the point is, without going into too much detail, it's quite common in countries which have aspirations in this industry to provide quite a lot of support. And just to take that point further, I mean, it's not only, well, when times are bad, governments also tend to pull out the checkbooks. And they were very bad in 2008, 2009. If you remember, General Motors was on the verge of bankrupt. In fact, it was kind of bankrupt and had to be bailed out by the US government. That then meant that Canada, for example, the Canadian government was then under pressure by the big three, Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors, who all have big plants in Canada, to say, well, look, the Americans are bailing us out, so we can't compete anymore. Maybe the Canadian government needs to give us some money as well. So there was this kind of knock-on effect. And then in Germany, Opel, which was a subsidiary of General Motors, that was wanting, you know, GM was wanting to sell that, of course, then Germany was sort of helping the buyer of that company in order to save the company and save jobs. So there's a huge amount, apart from the financial sector, more money, more support and money went to the automotive industry than any other global sector. It amounted, in fact, to close to $100 billion of support was channeled into the industry at the time of the financial and economic crisis of 2008 and 2009. So, okay, the point is that this is a sector which is quite good at garnering support from governments. And, you know, for good reasons. It employs a lot of people, it's got technology spin-offs, etc., etc. Okay, so that's by way of introduction to the global context in which now South African government is trying to develop the industry. And if we go back to the sort of earlier period, and the first investments in the automotive industry actually go right back to the 1920s in Port Elizabeth, when General Motors and Ford set up plants. We had a history of high protection. I'm sure you will remember, you know, my students don't remember, but the times sort of in the 80s and so on, when actually all the cars that were on South African roads were locally produced, with the exception of one or two, 99% were locally assembled. And there was much less choice at that point. And the reason was simply that tariffs were, the protection was 115%. So there was 105% import duty and a 10% import surcharge. So to bring in a car, you really had to not be too concerned about the money. And there were a few imports. I mean, there were some exotic cars, maybe the odd Porsche, where you don't actually mind if you're going to spend R1 million or R2 million on the car. The local content requirements were imposed since 1961, which meant, and this is very important, because the value of the car is certainly not, you know, what Volkswagen and General Motors do. It's really the value or the kind of production and the employment is much more in making the parts that go into that car. So there were efforts to develop the component industry with local content requirements since 1961. And then in 1989, another important policy development, which was a kind of gradual start of reforming the process, Because from 1961, we'd actually had measured local content by weight. Now, think of the policy measure where you decide that the heavier the parts, the more local content you'll have, and that is going to meet the government requirement. So there's a level that you had to 50% local content and 60% local content, and so on, measured by weight. Now, of course, I read that this actually led to heavier parts being produced, and I thought, this, you know, how can that really affect? But actually, it was the case that some of the component producers were actually deliberately producing heavy parts to qualify or to raise the local content for manufacturers in this process. Now, I mean, that's clearly nonsensical, and especially when you start to include electronics, which are high value parts but are very light. So, belatedly, in 1989, the policy arrangement was changed, and phase six moved to measuring local content by value. But the upshot is that by the early 1990s, when the political transition was starting to get underway, we were sitting with a very high cost and inefficient industry. Investment was low, the start of investment. I mean, Japanese firms were not allowed to invest in South Africa. Of course, we had Toyota operating, but it was South African owned and used imported technology. Exports were minimal. Most plants were producing in very low volume, and they were producing many different models. So this meant that they were extremely inefficient because you could not achieve economies of scale. And I'll say a lot more about that in a minute. So the South African industry was a very small fish in a very big pond at that time. So the big change was in 1995. We had the introduction of the Motor Industry Development Program. Local content requirements were abolished. There were gradual tariff reductions, quite rapid at first, but then down to 65% in 95 and 30% in 2007. In fact, this year they go to 25%. Duty free allowance for components, don't need to worry too much about that. I think an important aspect, though, was import-export complementation. So what this allowed firms to do was, if they're exporting, they could then import duty-free. So if you're exporting cars or components, you could import cars or components duty-free. So the idea was to encourage a company like, say, BMW, which produced at that time the 7 Series, the 5 Series, and the 3 Series, all in one tiny little plant, and I mean, they were producing, you know, probably less than 1,000 7 Series cars a year. It was totally uneconomic. To encourage them to start producing the 3 Series, for example, in high volumes, export those, and then they could offset duties and import the other vehicles, which is what they started doing. So really, the idea of that policy was to encourage the specialization and allow South African plants to get up to a reasonable level of efficient production. Okay, so the objectives, low vehicle prices, sustainable industry and employment, of course, improved economic contribution, these are things that the governments would always like to do. And this was to be achieved by a phased integration into the global industry, for example, BMW exporting and importing and therefore becoming integrated into the global industry. And as I said, to increase volumes and economies of scale through growing exports and gradual rationalization of the industry. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It was actually, there was a motor industry task group which was set up in about 92, 93. And that was a everything that those that you probably remember was a tripartite. The unions were involved, the government and business, and that's how that operated. And in fact, I was at that time asked by Alec Irwin, who was the education secretary for NUMSA, the Metalworkers Union, to advise them on that process. And I then later became a sort of part-time government advisor as well. But basically, it was a combination of officials in the pre-94 government, and then industry stakeholders, trade union stakeholders, really put together this plan. I mean, I literally went to dozens and dozens of meetings held at the IDC over a period of a couple of years. Of course, one drew quite heavily on what was happening elsewhere in other countries. One could write a book on that process. Actually, obviously you had a massive contestation between the different interests, the component suppliers versus the car producers in particular. I mean, their interests were very much at loggerheads. Okay, so just to give a snapshot of the industry, we saw very kind of slow growth in the 1980s and 1990s. I think Nikki Natras earlier this week showed how per capita incomes actually fell in the 1980s. And in fact, the record figure for sales was achieved in 1981. It was at about 450,000, which was then only kind of surpassed in 2004. So you can just think of the kind of long recessional period of stagnant growth that the economy went through. And if you go back to 1960, South Africa actually had the largest industry of any emerging market or developing country, larger than Brazil, larger than China, much larger than India, larger than Korea even, larger than Mexico. And so I think that just tells us actually how badly the economy performed. If you know, we haven't got the 1980s here, but there's a long period of sort of stagnant growth, obviously cyclical as well. And then it's only really been, say, since about 2002 that we've had the uptick. Of course, there was a recession, and now sales are starting to increase again. I mentioned exports, and I think this has been one of the big successes of the industry, is that it has become quite successful in terms of exporting. The share of exports is indicated in this line here, and you can see that the share of production has really grown very substantially, the share of exports and production. That's the share of exports in production. But of course, imports have increased as well. So, you know, we've had growing imports and growing exports. So the green line shows the share of exports on this right-hand axis. Over 50%. I mean, here, exports were non-existent, obviously. Okay, so here we see the growth in exports, quite high numbers, and we've got light commercial vehicles and passenger vehicles. Rapid growth off a tiny base. The other part of this, though, has been as tariffs have come down, I mean, there's almost a perfect inverse relationship. The imports as a share of domestic sales have increased quite rapidly. So this has obviously now become quite a big policy issue. And that is, in fact, why government has decided not to reduce tariffs beyond the 2012 figure of 25%. Surprisingly, the European Union, even to, they vary quite a lot, and that changes quite a lot from year to year, but when we export cars to Japan, BMWs for example, we export to the US, we export to Australia, we export to some markets in Africa, but they are generally quite small. We export to many smaller economies, I mean, like Mauritius and so on as well. But I would say the biggest, and it does fluctuate a lot, the biggest markets over the last, say, 10 years have been, certainly in the European Union, including Germany, Britain, US, those have been the biggest ones. So it's really the way exports are organized is, you know, it's all planned by the car companies. They all say, look, we need to supply this market. Where's the best location going to be? They may get different supplier plants to actually bid for those contracts, and it'll therefore optimize its global production system. Okay, now I want to get onto this question of scale, because I mentioned, you know, the importance of having economies of scale and achieving large-scale production to be efficient in this industry. This shows the position in the 1980s, right, going back to the late 1980s, and it shows you Japanese companies operating in Japan, US companies operating in North America, all companies operating in Europe, so that's including Japanese and European and American firms, the newly industrialized countries, and then Australia, and then we've got South Africa. This actually shows the largest plant, how much they were producing per day, and then the smallest plant and the kind of average. But again, you see South Africa absolutely tiny. I mean, this plant here in Europe is Volkswagen plant in Wolfsburg in Germany, which I've been to. It's absolutely massive. The whole city is really built around the automotive industry, and it's churning out, well, I can't work out how many cars per minute, but it's absolutely massive scale of production. And so the tiny little South African plants were having to compete, you know, with much bigger and much more cost-effective plants in these other countries, including in the newly industrialized countries. I think this was a Korean factory producing at quite large-scale production. Okay, to show that again, because this is very important and this has really been a key issue in the policy debates, is here we talk about production volumes in thousands in different countries, and this shows the number of car models being produced. Well, for example, here we've got a situation where in China there were two plants producing between 20 and 50,000 cars per year. It was one plant producing over 100,000 cars per year. Now, to achieve efficient scale, where you can actually reduce your production costs per vehicle, you really want to be producing over 100,000 cars per year out of one plant. That's the kind of industry standard, and there's a debate as well about that. We see that, or you want to certainly be in 50 to 100,000 category, but we see that South Africa had 17 plants producing less than 20,000 cars. That really is a tiny number. And here we talk of model volumes, not cars in the whole plant. You're talking per model. So that would be the BMW 5 Series is one model. The BMW 7 Series would be another model. Or the Toyota Camry would be one, and the Toyota Corolla would be another model. Other countries like Thailand and Indonesia were in a similar situation. Brazil was much better off with 5 plants producing over 100,000 vehicles per year. Okay, so just to emphasize the point that we were in this kind of space of producing small plants, producing many different models at very low volume. You can't operate like that and hope to be globally competitive. Okay, so that was the situation in the mid-90s. Now, why is this important? Well, just to expand a bit on the question of minimum efficient scale, these are estimates of the volumes per year that you're required to get to achieve a minimum efficient scale of production. Okay. With regard to vehicle assembly, well, I said 100,000, but in fact, some estimates really put it higher. Engine block castings, engine block machining, casting of various other parts, stampings. These are like producing door panels and other metal pressings. Maybe as many as 1 or 2 million per year. So you really do need, in many of these production processes, you've got to be producing large quantities of output. And I think the motor industry is is a particular example where scale is important. Yes, per plant, yeah. So, I mean, the idea was that if you increase vehicle volumes, achieve scale economies in components, and reduce costs, that'll help reduce vehicle prices, which will help you increase vehicle volumes. Same, achieve scale economies in assembly costs, reduce vehicle prices, and get into that kind of virtuous circle. So that was one of the ideas which was driving policy at that time, to try and achieve a higher volume. What actually happened? Well, here we see the situation in 1993, and this is referring to passenger cars only. There were 16 models being produced in volumes of less than 20,000, as we showed in the previous diagram. And there was just one model being produced in volumes of 20 to 40,000. So there wasn't much change by 1996 or by 1999, but by 2002, the picture had started to change. This is when the export program started to take effect. For example, BMW, which was one of the first to restructure its plant, started to export the 3 Series and import its other requirements. And then by 2005, there'd been quite a substantial change. Compare that with this, where you've got, that looks like 4 vehicle models being produced in volumes of 40,000 and more, and a much reduced overall number, because I mean, you've just got 12 models being produced there, that's 4, 4, and 4. And here we had, you know, many models being produced in these tiny, tiny volumes. So really, policy was trying to, you know, push the industry into producing in volumes of 40,000 or more. 40,000 itself is actually not sufficient. The reason for that, well, one of the important reasons was it became economic. If you achieve reasonable volumes, it then becomes economic for component suppliers to actually start supplying that plant. If you're producing, say, 1,000 7 Series BMWs per year, you cannot expect makers of components, say body pressings or whatever, to make the investments required to supply parts to that vehicle. If you start producing 100,000 or more per year, then you can expect more investment in local content. And remember that tariffs were coming down for components. There was more and more pressure from imports. So it was absolutely essential from the component industry point of view to get the volumes, or to get the vehicle assemblers producing the volumes which would allow them to achieve scale economies and start to be competitive. What we've actually seen, and there are different measures of local content, so I won't go into all of that, but I mean there are different ways you can define local content. It's actually quite difficult to measure. We haven't seen much increase in local content. In fact, it tends to fluctuate with the exchange rate. It's been pretty flat for the most part. But remember that this has been an industry which has become more and more competitive. So I think it has helped. The fact that there are higher volumes has to some extent helped the component industry to survive and start to become competitive, because the volumes that are being produced and the volumes that they can then supply to the assembly industry have increased. So to summarize, the growth performance since 1995. I think the industry has performed relatively well compared to the objectives that were set in 1995. Positive, there's been turnover growth, there's been export growth. Of course, there was a big recession a couple of years ago, which really was a massive blow to the industry. It's certainly become a lot more competitive. When I visited the Mercedes plant in East London about, let's say, 15 years ago, and it was a really depressing sight. I mean, it was this kind of in bad state of repair. They were producing very low volumes. They were producing a Mitsubishi pickup, a couple of Mercedes models, trucks as well, you know, a whole range of cars, and very, very low volumes. You go to that plant today, it's a modern plant, actually similar to what you would see in Europe. Perhaps certainly less automated, but very modern, very large investment, and producing a reasonable volume of Mercedes C-Class cars and exporting them around the world, including to Japan and so on. So the quality has to be absolutely equivalent to what you would have in Germany. In fact, when BMW first started exporting cars to Japan, the distributors there were unhappy to be getting cars from South Africa rather than Germany. And they said, look, this is going to be a problem. Our buyers, you know, will not really want cars from Africa. But in fact, that phase went. I mean, the quality was identical, if not better, from South Africa, and that whole issue disappeared. But on the negative side, import levels have increased a lot, as I showed you. And that's both in terms of, well, local content. There's been little increase in local content, which remains quite low, and vehicle imports. Perhaps more neutral has been employment. Employment has tended to stay steady, and of course, fluctuating as well. And investment levels have been quite reasonable, but not as high as you're getting in the most dynamic markets, such as Thailand and, of course, China and so on. And then the industry has performed well if you compare it to the manufacturing average. Again, it depends on which time frame you look at, because this industry tends to be very cyclical. In a recession, it really tends to hit the bottom quite badly. But in terms of contributions to manufacturing sales, to employment, value-added gross salaries, its share has actually increased relative to the manufacturing average. And there's been quite rapid increases in labor productivity as well. Okay, so to look at the future, what is attainable? Well, I mean, the current government plan, or the new government plan, sets a target, or kind of notional target, 1.2 million vehicles to be produced by 2020. This would require ongoing support. There will be some protection will be maintained, as I'll show you in the next slide. There's trying to be, government's trying to achieve more balanced growth between exports and the domestic market. As you saw with MIDP, we had this massive increase in exports, but the domestic market lost ground quite a lot with growing imports as well. And then it's going to be important to continue to discourage the proliferation of low-volume models. So one doesn't want to go back to the system that we had in the mid-90s of these low-volume models being produced by most car, or by all car makers. And I think what's also very important consideration for government is free trade arrangements. As we saw, these are critically important. There's a lot of discussions with Brazil, with India, etc. You know, how can you expand access to various markets by companies producing cars in South Africa to achieve economies of scale and to achieve some specialization? Because you cannot try and produce everything for the domestic market in this very scale-intensive industry. So I won't say too much about this, but this is the new automotive production development program, which will run from next year to 2020. And basically, the idea is to assist the industry to become more sustainable over time. It's World Trade Organization compliant, which the Motor Industry Development Program was not. So there was a threatened challenge, in fact, from the WTO because of the export subsidy, which is built into the Motor Industry Development Program. So this contains a couple of important elements. The tariffs for vehicles and components. And just to show you, of course, they've been coming down. They're now going to flatten out. So the government's decided, which I think is actually right, and we can perhaps debate it, that tariffs should not decline any further below the 25% level. Some people would say, hey, well, bring tariffs down, make industry competitive, make prices as low as possible. And then there's other elements as well which I need to go into: a local assembly allowance, production incentive, automotive investment scheme. In my view, the government's actually giving industry too much support, but and also another aspect of this is that these support measures are kind of, you could say, paid out to firms in the form of import credits. So basically, it allows firms to import cars and components on a duty-free or semi-duty-free basis which obviously is going to undercut the domestic market to some extent, but on the other hand, does make the industry more competitive and does reduce the cost of its inputs. So perhaps we can just end with two short slides to, you know, just highlight some points, and we may want to debate this in question time. Should the government be continuing to support the industry, and if so, to what level? Well, the critics would say that the motor industry development program involves high costs in terms of protection. It does raise the price of vehicles in the country. Although, actually, our prices are not, well, it depends. I mean, it depends which country you're comparing it, what exchange rate, etc. South African prices are not that high. Certainly, they're high compared to the US, but they're not that high compared to some other markets. Nevertheless, there are high costs to the MIDP. And there's also the argument that lower prices would mean more cars on the road. If you really reduce, if you had complete free trade in vehicles, for example, you could allow used cars to be imported from Japan. The Japanese rules to support the industry, they actually make it a requirement that your roadworthy certification becomes very difficult after 3 years. And then Japanese buyers sell their cars, and a lot of those get exported to places like New Zealand and parts of Africa as well, in fact. But they are very, very cheap. And there's no way that the local industry could compete with that. But that would mean more cars on the road, and therefore more employment in distribution, servicing, repairs, etc. On the other side, what are the arguments for ongoing support? Well, firstly, protection has already been sharply reduced, and we saw that the level of imports had increased quite substantially. So you might get to a situation where further reductions lead to major plant closures, and certainly this is something that government would have difficulty in contemplating. I mean, take, for example, East London, a very depressed area, where Mercedes is by far the largest employer in the whole region. And certainly government would not like to see a plant like that shut down. Another point is that the adjustment costs, of course, to free trade would be high, as I said, you know, plants shutting down, etc. Other countries, as I said, do offer large-scale support, so we certainly not unusual in that respect. In some ways, we offer less support than some other competitor countries. It's also possible that reducing protection might reduce economies of scale. For example, if you reduce protection, imports rise, production volumes fall in South African factories, and that means that they are further away from achieving economies of scale. So that's a possible further disadvantage. And then I guess the key question is, you know, can the industry become competitive over time? And I think this is really the fundamental point. I mean, if we've had industry in South Africa for a long time, but we did go through very turbulent times and very low growth period, and Africa as well has been a kind of disastrous market, really, but that's actually changed over the last 10 years. I think it's going to change a lot more in the next 20 years. So the question is whether the industry can become more competitive and actually develop dynamic comparative advantage. And clearly, the size of the domestic and regional market is going to be important, and you know, the question of whether South Africa or Southern Africa can become a regional automotive space. So I'll end off there, and we've now got 10 minutes or so for questions or comments. And
what's the balance on the trade, imports and exports?
So sorry, the balance of trade. Okay, I think what I'll do is I'll take a few questions, and then I'll answer those. And so it's the balance of trade. Let me just make a note. Okay. What was that due to WTO, right? The tariff reductions. Okay. So the productivity had dropped. Well, yeah, okay. So, okay. All right, let's take, yes?
It's not the case, as in the case India has advocated, for the production of appropriate vehicle for the marketplace,
okay, an appropriate vehicle, okay. Okay, let's take one more question, and then I'll answer those, and we'll have another round.
I understand the need for the economy of scale, but isn't there also a market for a niche market manufacturer set up?
Okay. Okay, let me... thank you for those questions. What's the balance of trade in the automotive industry, your question? We've always had a trade deficit in this sector, and the reasoning is if you go back to sort of the 1980s or before that, we were importing a lot of parts and we were exporting virtually nothing, even though we were making all the cars domestically. Now we're exporting quite a lot of cars and components, but we're importing even more. And so it does depend on the situation. For example, our trade deficit widened during the economic boom of 2006-2007. Then during the recession, the trade deficit in the sector actually declined because we were importing less. Exports tended to be quite stable, although our exports now are struggling a bit. Sorry, I'm going to open the mic. Exports now are struggling a bit because the European Union has got quite serious problems of its own. So we still have a trade deficit in this sector. Sorry, it is quite big, yeah. It's one of our biggest import items remains parts and vehicles. I think it's the second biggest after machinery. The question about, or the comment about the WTO, well, this is interesting. The tariffs have actually been reduced below WTO requirements. And sometimes it's quite useful for government to say, for example, the trade unions, well, you know, WTO is forcing us to reduce tariffs. But actually, the reality is that South African tariffs have been reduced below WTO requirements. Having said that, the WTO, the export subsidy that was contained in the Motor Industry Development Programme is illegal in terms of WTO rules, and that was one of the reasons why it's now being changed. So, certainly the WTO is a much bigger factor now than it used to be. But there are also many countries which break those rules. The question of appropriate vehicles. This is an interesting one. Some of you might remember the Ranger. It was a Chevrolet or General Motors, I think, produced, which was a kind of produced by General Motors, it was a Chevrolet car, the Ranger. But it was basically a South African car. It wasn't being produced anywhere else. I mean, it was kind of had a lot of common components with other vehicles, but it was a South African car. The trouble with that is, you need the market, you need the technology. I mean, is there a South African firm which is going to develop such a product? In fact, one South African product which is under development is the Jewel, which is an electric car, which is being sort of prototypes being built in Cape Town. I think that's got a long way to go before it becomes anything possibly viable. Cars for African conditions, maybe pickups and so on. There's been quite a lot of talk about that, but the trouble is that the investments required for producing a new model are absolutely astronomical. And certainly there's scope for a third world car, I guess, or sort of rough and ready. Really car which could be sold in Africa and other parts of Asia and so on. But, of course some countries have gone the route of producing their own car, like Malaysia with the Proton. That's been a disaster. I mean, it's been a financial disaster for Malaysia. Well, it's not a complete disaster, but it's been very, very expensive. And on the other hand, Korea has been very successful. They said at the start, Korea said, well, we will allow Hyundai to produce passenger cars, we'll allow Daewoo to produce commercial vehicles, And Samsung must just stay out of the car industry. They can stick with computers and stuff like that. So they actually allocated to these big firms, and they said, look, you're going to produce this. We'll give you cheap finance, but you've got to meet these export requirements and so on. So Korea has been one of the few successful success stories actually developing its own industry. And of course, India and China are certainly developing big local companies. But I think it's very difficult and potentially very expensive. Then the niche markets, we can. I think to some extent that's what we do. We are a niche market producer. For example, the CDs, BMW, those are sort of not mass volume producers like Toyota or Fiat. And I think in the component industry, we've been very successful as a niche market producer. For example, producing low volume products for the aftermarket, where the big international producers are not worried about, producing small volumes of components for replacement parts and so on. So I think to some extent South Africa is a niche market producer, but you still need to compete with the high volume producers, and that's why you need to get reasonably high production volumes. Okay, let me just take another round. We've had a few questions, okay? So your question? By competing, okay.
What kind of, in terms of an employer, what are the volumes of employment that this industry has?
Okay. All right, yes?
Why is Toyota importing Avanzas from Indonesia? And why are there so many, apparently more cosmetic than anything else, changes every new model? Isn't that very costly or wasteful?
Okay.
For Anna.
Right, okay. Can I take two more questions? Because I don't want to run out of time, but I'm very happy to ask questions at the end. So if I could just take your question and your question.
Can you expand on your comment about the
Jewel? Jewel, okay. I'd like you to ask two questions, but that's fine. Okay. Okay, thanks once again. I think I should actually take no more questions, if you don't mind. I'm very happy to answer questions afterwards, but I'm aware that it's Friday evening and, I'm sure people have got plans. Okay. It's the competition and employment. Well, I mean, there's competitive... I mean, companies and countries compete, and of course, they may use government support to improve their competitiveness. Of course, subsidies will always make you more competitive, but the question is, do they make you more competitive in a sustainable way? Now, employment in this industry is a big employer. It's important to point out that the employment in production is about roughly, say, 80,000. Workers, or no, it's actually a bit more, it's probably close to 100,000 workers, but actually more people involved in distribution, servicing, repair, petrol, etc. So the service side of the industry in terms of employment is actually bigger than the production side of employment. Although, of course, the production work, production jobs will tend to be more highly paid and perhaps more highly skilled. And there's a question about the Avanza. Well, what is the Toyota import the Avanza from Indonesia? Well, I'm not quite sure. You see, what they tend to do is they optimize their production around the world, right? and they decide, well, we're going to produce this car here, export to these markets, we'll produce the Corolla in South Africa and export to perhaps back to Indonesia. So I guess, you know, I don't know the detail of that particular decision, but that's what they tend to do. They try and focus production in a few production locations. Now, the changes to new models and why a lot of them are cosmetic, that's absolutely right. And I guess that's just, you know, trying to get market share and so on. And what happened, if you remember, we had, you know, the City Golf, we had the old Taz. These were cars which didn't change very much for a long period. And that was really simply a kind of hangover from heavy protection. In fact, it wasn't so long ago that Mexico was still producing the old Beetle. Again, heavy protection made it too expensive for companies to keep up with new models. But now in a competitive world, if you want to export, you've got to keep up with all these cosmetic changes. Okay, then the Jewel. Well, that's an interesting project. It's being supported by government, and I hope it works, but I must say the trouble is you're competing with massive firms which are investing billions of dollars. I mean, I test drove the Nissan Leaf and also Renault at COP17. You know, these are really superb vehicles. They're very expensive to buy at the moment. Although, so I do think that electric cars have got a future. The Jewel, well, let's hope it works, but I think they do need a big investor to actually optimize the production and expand production. I think they need an investor to actually go beyond the prototype stage. But it would be great if we could have a South African car with that kind of green technology which could actually work. And then the last question about subsidies, and then I'll end off. What percentage of subsidies go to the car industry and what percentage of employment? Well, there have been some treasury figures which showed that the MIDP was garnering a huge percentage of state subsidies. I don't actually agree with those figures. I mean, I think the subsidies are large to the industry, but I don't agree with the way they've calculated them. But nevertheless, I do think that, and the other point is that support has been phasing down quite rapidly as tariffs have declined. So I think it's certainly true. I mean, in my view, the subsidies, if there are subsidies going to industry and to employment, they should be going to industries which employ people or economic activities which employ people. For example, we do in South Africa spend a lot of money supporting heavy industry, cheap electricity, tax breaks, dedicated infrastructure to support aluminium plants and so on, which actually generate very little employment and also have the added effect of putting strain on our sort of power supplies, higher emissions and so on. So I do think, and this is another big topic, that subsidies should, in this country, should be going to economic activities which are going to generate much more employment. And the motor industry doesn't really fall into that category. Okay, so I think, thanks very much. I think I should end off there, and thank you very much for attending. Personally, for what they should do in the clothing industry, if they want to support it, would be, well, I think would be to provide protection in Africa for the African market and African production to develop. You know, most industrial development has started with the clothing industry. I'm not talking about South Africa because we're already beyond that stage and we're not really going to compete. Although I think we could do a lot better than we are doing if we actually change our labour regulation.
think we need to change the attitude of our management in the clothing industry, but more than the labor regulations. But he's now.
Are you saying that they're just not far-sighted enough?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's.
There seems to be.
I think there's slowly a change, and there are a couple of very successful companies. But by and large, I think in 1994, the clothing industry, sort of life would go on forever.
Yeah, and there's been this big fight between industry and government, and so on. They just don't seem to have sorted out, sorted themselves out. Whereas I think in the motor industry, there's been a better relationship between industry and government.
The less players.
For the most part.
The less players,
exactly. You've got a very strong federation.
You've got what?
Yeah.
And then I think manufacturers.
Yeah.
They've got, I don't know, 100,000.
So the clothing industry has been a very sad story, actually.
Especially, isn't it?
So. Oh, really? Oh, okay. Well, okay. Yeah, well, so my colleagues do quite a lot of work on that. And you perhaps know Mike Morris.
I've seen some of his stuff.
Okay. Well, I think I think it could be doing a lot better than it's doing. I think it's very unfortunate, actually, what's happened.
Yeah. I think so, too. Yeah. Because, I mean, that is probably the lowest.
Well, exactly. That's where you can really generate. But I think government's got to think big. I think they could be looking, export processing zones, some adjustments on the labour story, and get people into a kind of positive mindset. That's because the industry is plagued by pessimism, I would say. That's my impression as an outsider.
I think the ones that are successful, they keep quiet.
Okay.
And the ones that are screaming are the ones that are unsuccessful, by and large, I think.
Okay. The transport costs, we're a long way from our markets, except for Africa, which is beginning to develop. So, do you have any idea of a percentage cost to transport a vehicle to, say, Malaysia or wherever it's headed, Australia or Brazil?
Well, all I can say is that the costs aren't quite significant. I don't know the actual percentage.
Would it be 10% or would it be less?
No, I think for a car it would be less than 10%, but it would be maybe more than 5%. And the other thing is that... Sorry, I'll switch off now. The other thing is that our ports charges are very high, and we're not really on the major shipping routes, so our transport shipping costs are low. In fact, I'm doing a comparison in South Africa and Thailand, trying to benchmark these things, and the transport costs are higher here. The port charges are higher, so that is also a disadvantage.
It's very important.
Location, inland or coastal? You've got to bring your cars inland.
Well, of course, BMW, they've got to export to the coast.
Yes.
And quite a few of the parts are inland.
Inland.
Well, there's Ford is inland. And Nissan. But the others are on the coast. It's all, it's the cost of getting it onto the ship. And these big ships don't, they can't. I mean, East London, that's where Mercedes is, that's a very small port, so there's not much else to drop off and collect.
Maybe some grain.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I'll ask you about the subsidies for the consumer.
Yes,
the
consumer.
Effectively, the consumer
is
paying a subsidy in the form of a higher unit price.
Yes. Okay. Well, you see, that's why governments prefer tariffs compared to actual subsidies.
And then that has marketing.
That's why governments prefer tariffs.